Bin Laden's son has recently showed up in propaganda videos calling for death to Americans and calling for lone wolf attacks and calling for attacks inside the United States and attacks in Washington, D.C. and France and Israel. He's exactly the kind of person that we should be capturing and questioning. You know, that I know that our current approach to these things is to just drop a hellfire missile on them and kill them and their family and anybody else that happens to be in the house. And I'm not against dropping hellfire missiles on terrorists, but I think you can't find out the long-range intentions by killing off everyone who could provide you with actionable intelligence.
No, it's the easy, low-risk course of action. God forbid should we put boots on the ground. God forbid should we sustain American casualties. All right, with us today on OPSEC Radio on the America Out Loud Radio Network, we have Dr. James Mitchell, PhD, clinical psychologist from USF. Dr. Mitchell is a retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel with 22 years as both a psychologist and an EOD tech, explosives and demolitions, clinical psychologist for personnel recovery, and the SEER, which is Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape, and ultimately, subsequent to his retirement, contractor with the CIA. Jim, thank you for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So I want to encourage all of our listeners to read a very informative book. Jim has just published Enhanced Interrogation: Inside the Minds and Motives of the Islamic Terrorists Trying to Destroy America. So, Jim, thanks for your service and for your sacrifice.
Well, thanks for the kind words. But, you know, with respect to protecting America, there are a lot of people involved in that. It's not just me. People are sacrificing their lives every day.
Well, we appreciate it. A lot of people don't have insight into this process, and I think there's probably a lot of misconceptions out there as far as what EIT and enhanced interrogation techniques are. There is no pulling out of fingernails. There's no stretching on the rack. And a lot of people think, myself, I've been through SEER twice. I went through before I was commissioned an area x-ray at Fort Bragg, and then I had the privilege to go back a second time during the Special Forces training. It's unpleasant, but it's not torture.
No, well, certainly, this was looked at by the Justice Department, the actual enhanced interrogation techniques were looked at by the Justice Department four or five times. And one of the times when they were asked to opine about whether or not waterboarding specifically constituted torture, one of the assistant attorney generals wanted to be waterboarded himself so that he would have the personal experience of that. And in the context of that, I waterboarded two attorneys, almost as many attorneys as were government attorneys as was terrorists were waterboarded. We only waterboarded three of those. So, and he opined right after that, a few days later, that it wasn't torture, that it didn't violate any of our treaty obligations, and it wasn't a violation of the constitutional rights.
I think all lawyers should be waterboarded at some point, but that's...
yes.
But, so to be clear, all high-risk U.S. servicemen and women, primarily aviators and special operators, go through the SEER training, the Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape, and a portion of that training is the Resistance Training Laboratory, which is, in effect, a prison compound where they're prepared for the event of their capture. You were highly involved in that program.
Right. I was there for 7 years, and I was the chief psychologist at the Air Force School, but I also helped out the executive agency. It had various names, but I think it's called the Joint Personnel Recovery Agency now.
Right.
And help them out with respect to some of the training they did. There's basically two courses that people take. In the Air Force, it's people who are high risk of capture, aviators, like you said, anybody that flies on an airplane, and certain other missions like pararescue and combat control, the kind of combat-oriented missions. And then there's a kind of a master's degree or a graduate degree in protecting secrets that you can get through the executive agency. And that's less about the mechanics of survival in terms of how do you build a hut and, you know, how do you make a fire and what can you eat, and more about how do you protect secrets.
The psychological aspects of it.
Yes.
Yeah, I think the other thing is you have to get inside the minds of the enemies that we're dealing with. And in this case, it was Islamic terrorists. We're programmed to think like Westerners because we are Westerners, primarily a Christian nation. But that paradigm doesn't work with these people. They don't think that way.
Right. I spent literally years from 2002 up through President Bush moved them to Guantanamo in 2006, I think it was September of 2006, with 13 of the worst terrorists, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the chief architect of the 9/11 attacks, and his crew, his henchmen that were still alive that were helping him do that, and Al-Nashri, the mastermind behind the U.S. Cole attack, and others like that. And one of the things that we spent quite a bit of time talking about, especially with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, because he liked to do that, was his religious motivations for attacking us. And that's the thing that I think is probably the most important thing for your listeners to come across, because sometimes when I hear people talk in general, or at least in the press, about the way these Islamists, and an Islamist is a person who believes that the whole world needs to be under Sharia law with a single Muslim caliphate in control. The difference between the kind of Islamist that ISIS is and the kind of Islamist that Al-Qaeda is really just a matter of degree. Al-Qaeda and KSM, the guy that did 9/11, they believe that in order to advance their conquering of the world and imposing Sharia law, they first have to kill off the United States, or at least take over the United States, or cripple it so badly that it won't fight them in order for them to have a free run at it. And that's what KSM was trying to do, whereas ISIS thinks they can just start a fight, battle their way, elbow their way into the Middle East, take over a big chunk of land, and then spread from there. So it's just a matter of focus and degree.
And KSM was truly shocked at George Bush's response after 9/11.
Yeah, what a lot of people don't know is that right after 9/11, KSM had other catastrophic plans in the works, which is the whole reason behind the EIT program, was to stop those specific plans. There was a person who we now know by the name of Hambali, who was training a group of East Asians, because we'd be on the lookout for Arabs. They're training them to crash planes into buildings in Los Angeles, Seattle, and Chicago, the tallest buildings in those three cities. And so they had some of them who were training in hand-to-hand combat and the use of improvised weapons to be able to control the passengers. And the stewards and the air marshals on the airplanes, and then others who were training to fly the planes into the building. And that attack was in its past its nascent stage, but it was chugging along, and he thought he had lots of time because he thought that what was going to happen. He told me, he said, I asked him, what were you thinking? What were you thinking when you, this is long after EITs were over, Dr. Jessen and I just said, what were you thinking? I mean, it's like you crashed those planes into those buildings fell down. And he said, well, first off, we were shocked when the buildings fell because we thought that what was going to happen was it would kill a few hundred people, maybe a few thousand people, but the buildings wouldn't fall. But then when the buildings fell, we thought, oh, that's a sign from Allah, and all the like-minded Muslims are going to rise up and attack America. It's a sign that we're right. And then he said, within just a few weeks, they were feeling lucky to just survive the night, because what he had expected was that George Bush would turn it over to the FBI, like Reagan did and like Clinton had done for the Cole and for the 1998 bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi, Kenya, and in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, that it would turn it over to the FBI, and that he'd have plenty of time, because the FBI moves kind of slow, trying to build a law enforcement case and find the exact people that were involved, and by then they'd have a chance to launch these attacks. And they had taken some steps to be sure that they weren't going to be extradited by the Taliban by helping them kill Massoud, the leader of the Northern Alliance, mm-hmm. helped the Taliban kill that guy, under the agreement that when the FBI came knocking, they wouldn't turn them over, because they had fully expected the Taliban to remain in control of Afghanistan. He said, but then George Bush said he wanted us dead or alive, and he invaded. And it was the swiftness and the ferocity of his attack in the first few weeks after 9/11 that actually got them stumbling a little bit and got them off kilter with respect to that one attack that they had planned, the big catastrophic attack. And then by the time they got up again where they could start moving forward on that attack, we had already caught Abu Zubaydah. Abu Zubaydah had helped us catch Ramzi bin Ashiba. Ramzi bin Ashiba helped us catch other people that eventually led to catching KSM. KSM helped us catch Hambali, and then that attack fell apart.
Yeah, that damn cowboy, George Bush. But it really is a house of cards, and finding that one clue that leads to another, that leads to another, and ultimately with the identification of the courier led to the death of Osama bin Laden.
Right. KSM played a role in that, too, although he didn't know he was. You know, his nephew, who KSM helped us catch, Omar Baluchi, told us that a man by the name of Ahmed al-Kuwaiti had carried a letter from UBL to Abu Faraj, appointing Abu Faraj KSM's successor, right? When we asked KSM about that, he said, no, that guy used to work for me, but he doesn't work for me, you know, but he's retired, he's not with him anymore. And then they had set up what they thought was a secret way to communicate, but the CIA people who were running, and we, you know, the people who were there, mm-hmm. knew this system that they used, and so we monitored it without interfering with it, so we could see what they were saying to each other. And right after he lied to us, he sent a message out on his secret system, whatever you do, don't tell him about the courier. And so that just signaled to folks that he was a very important person. And then they started picking up pieces of information from this detainee and that detainee that helped them get a partial true name. And the brilliant analysts at CIA were able to go back into the records and sort out who this courier actually was. In fact, one of the last people that I did my last enhanced interrogation in the summer of 2003, and it was a very short one on a man by the name of Abu Yasser al-Jaziri. And he was able to tell the CIA that the man they were looking for, the courier, UBL's courier, actually had a speech impediment. And what he did was he spoke in both Pashto and Arabic, and the words were mixed up like a salad. He just, because of his speech impediment, he just used both languages simultaneously, and it was very difficult to understand him. So the CIA, through their collection abilities, were able to specifically identify where that guy lived in Pakistan, and were eventually able to verify that he was living with UBL, and then were eventually able to go in and kill him.
Yeah, you know, I've got to give these guys credit. Evil creatures that they are, they knew what they had to hold out on and protect, and they did a pretty good job of it, considering, you know, what they told you valuable information without telling you that eventually led to what they were trying to protect.
Yeah, well, our experience with detainees were that you know, you have to imagine that what they want to keep secret really falls on a continuum. There are some things they really, really, really want to keep secret. Like, I believe you'd have a difficult time forcing KSM to give up information about the courier, because he's brilliant and he knew we would eventually find UBL. So he was going to protect that with his life. But his underlings didn't have that same level of commitment, and after EITs, they provided information that allowed us to piece that, you know, General Hayden calls the problem of intelligence collection as putting together a puzzle without ever being able to look at the picture on the box, right? And so what we're trying to do is not get the definitive answer. We would like that, and it'd be great if we could get it. But what we're trying to do is get another piece of that puzzle. So we don't have the convenience or the resources to be able to look at the picture of the box, and we don't even know what the puzzle pieces look like sometimes. But what happens is, like I said, the brilliant people at the CIA were able to take these small pieces of information, plug them into the intelligence matrix, and eventually find that guy.
You're listening to the America Out Loud Talk Radio Network. Well, it's where we say, let the silent voices be heard. You'll find a whole host of shows and a lineup of great content back at AmericaOutLoud.com.
I imagine that was valuable information as far as their perspective, and then just determining.
Well, we used it for social influence. We used it for social influence stuff, because basically the way people have the wrong idea about EATs. If you just watch the news, you would think that, well, Abu Zubaydah, for example, was held 1,600 and I think 23 days or something like that, over 1,600 days. And he only had 14 days of EATs. That's 14 days out of 1,600. And beyond that, he was helping us. Now, he didn't tell us everything, but he told us enough that the men and women who were the analysts at the CIA who had the intelligence requirements could piece together and put it in a matrix and use it to get actionable intelligence. The same thing was true for KSM. Now, KSM probably had more EITs than most folks because of who he was and what he was trying to protect. But even at that, he was only exposed to 21 days of EITs from me and Doc Jessen and the man I call the preacher in my book. 21 days, that's 3 weeks. He was held 1,280-something days. That's another 170 weeks where he worked more or less with the CIA. So it's a very minuscule fraction of the time that you actually used EITs. And the point of those EITs was to get them working with you so you could switch to social influence. And to get back to the question that you asked me, when we were using EITs on KSM and we were wanting him to progress some so that we could switch to social influence stuff and quit using the EITs, at one point I said to him, he liked to be called Mukhtar, so I said, Mukhtar, I don't know about your God, because I just don't know about your God, but my God doesn't expect me to carry a burden that's too great for me to bear. He knows I'm going to get tired and put it down. And he said, my God feels exactly the same way. So we were able to take some of the things that Abu Zubaydah had told us about their religious perspective and roll those into our social influence techniques to plant the idea that he didn't have to resist on everything, the whole time.
And the social influencing techniques are much more productive. The EITs, I guess, would be a mechanism not so much to get information directly, but to move to the social influencing techniques.
Right.
Because the interrogations are not, you're not asking him or, forcing information out while you're pouring water up his nose.
No, that actually would be counterproductive.
Right.
And that's the myth, and that's the misperception. It works more like a dental phobia. You know, if a person has a dental phobia, tries the hardest to get out of going to the dentist, just as they're reaching for the door to go into the dentist's office, they struggle for a way to get out. And the way the EITs work is actually, in spite of the fact that the current Army field manual doesn't allow you to use physical coercion, EITs use basically the same template. And that template is you put the person in a difficult situation and then give them a way out of that situation by answering questions. So when the person was being waterboarded, for example, we weren't screaming, "Where's Bin Laden?" like you see in Zero Dark 30, or we weren't, you know, saying, "Tell us where the attack is."
Yeah.
What we were literally saying to him while we were pouring water is, "We want information to stop operations inside the United States. We know you don't have all of it, but you have some of it. And the way to avoid this the next time is to provide us with a piece of that information." And we had the subject matter experts on WMD and the subject matter experts on targeting the various Al-Qaeda members and the financial folks all working with us, mostly some of them right there. And we could, so what we would have is we would have sort of a neutral assessment before each session to see if he would start providing information. And if he did, then we moved away from EITs.
And you guys didn't jump right to the waterboarding. There was the, was the culmination of, what, 13 other techniques or 12 others? So.
Well, yeah, yes. The waterboard was considered by the Justice Department and by this by us as being the most invasive of all of those things. You know, when you're waterboarding a person, you have a physician there that's watching and can stop it and has been specifically charged by the CIA to let no harm come to the person that's being waterboarded. You have a psychologist that's there and watching and has been specifically charged to let no harm come to it. And then you have four or five senior CIA officers who are watching and in charge and in control and can stop it anytime they want. You have, you know, more than two handfuls of CIA police officers who were there, and you have the subject matter experts who were there as well, any of whom could have stopped any of these interrogations anytime they wanted to. And they're watching every single interrogation of a particular person. In addition, by name, you had to have permission to use whatever techniques you were going to use for that specific detainee. So you had to submit an interrogation plan that had to be approved by the person who was in charge at the site and then had to be approved at CIA headquarters by the Office of the Director.
One of the big problems that I had with the president, actually, was his declassification. Now, that's different from leaking information. That was a conscious effort that he declassified the enhanced interrogation techniques. Now, granted, they had already been compromised by the Egyptian intelligence officer, and were being put into Al-Qaeda training, but it detracted from the fear of the unknown.
Yeah, some of that is true. Some of that, it didn't work that way. I mean, I agree it can work the way that you said, and I agree that it did work the way that you said. But there were also those people who after it became known in 2004 that the CIA was using rough techniques, and there were rumors about what those were, there were at least two senior-level Al-Qaeda people who, remember what Abu Zubaydah said, if the brother knows in his heart that he can't hold out at all, he's not required to.
Mm-hmm.
And there were at least two of those guys who, when they showed up, who were resisting when other liaison officers were holding them, but when they were turned over to the CIA and CIA officers took the hoods off their head, they said, "I know who you guys are. I know what you can do. You don't have to do that. I'll talk." And so it works both ways. And that's the reason that you can't have a cookie cutter approach to things, because everybody is different. For some people, the thing that motivates them is, you know, anger at being betrayed by their unit, for example, or it may be a feeling of being unable to get out of this difficult situation without answering questions, or it may be that they're going to answer questions because they're concerned that if they don't, you know, somehow people they love are going to be hurt or something like that. So it really varies based on the person, but your point is well taken that there was harm that was done, and it would have been better if it had just been the rumors and not the actual techniques.
From my own personal experience, the first time I went through SEER, I was a young man. I was still a teen. I was 19 years old, I think. So I didn't know what to expect. Everybody went to Fort Lauderdale, Fort Walton Beach for their spring break. I went to Fort Bragg. And, you know, it was, I was young, but I was thankful for the opportunity. And ultimately, aside from the physical pain and discomfort, it was a great experience. Years later, when I went back during Special Forces training, you know, I had asked them, I said, well, I already did this. I have the training certificate. And they said, well, don't you want to go through with your peers? I said, no, not really. But no. I did. I went through it again. And to be fair, it was a lot more organized. We had the resistance training lab. You know, the cells were built. It was a lot more sophisticated as far as the organizational curriculum as well as the facilities. But what was missing for me was the fear of the unknown, because right. I knew what to expect. I knew that I was going to get walled and slammed against things, but it wasn't going to hurt. And it was disorienting for sure, but right. I knew I wasn't going to get hurt. In fact, let's talk about the walling, especially is one of the techniques. There's a whole, I was put in stress positions in Ranger school, just in the front leaning rest push up position with my feet above my head, and basically until you collapse, no harm. It's right. physically demanding, but no harm. I didn't like being jammed into a tiny box. I'm not a particularly claustrophobic person, but it wasn't pleasant. I feared the people's pond in November. I didn't want to get wet until I was hypothermic. No harm comes from that.
If it's carefully monitored, of course, it would be.
Right, right.
And in fact, here's one of the things that's deceptive about this. Some groups like the ACLU have said that the EITs lacked the safeguards that the SEER program had. And I actually think that's not true, because whereas you were probably part of a large class, I know when I was the psychologist at the SEER school, we sometimes had as many as 120 students. Well, there was one psychologist watching 120 students get interrogated, right? Whereas with Abba Zubaydah and the others, there was one psychologist watching one detainee get interrogated.
Yeah, yeah.
There was one physician watching one detainee get interrogated. Anyone could stop it. Not anyone can stop an interrogation at the SEER school. And the other point is that they would say, well, the SEER school has a safe word. You can do, you can use it, whatever that safe word is. Well, actually, the detainees have a safe word, too. They can say, I'll answer your question. Mm-hmm. And they can stop it anytime they want to. So that's the takeaway. But, one of the things I'm hoping we'll get a chance to talk a little bit about is what they're targeting with when they do these terror attacks. Because, the government, I think it was Barack Obama, recently said that Al-Qaeda and ISIS and terrorism in general doesn't represent an existential threat to the American government. And I think that just mischaracterizes it, because, as a guy who's
Absolute.
Been, like you have, at the tip of the spear, what I hear when somebody says that is you can't kill enough Americans to bring down the government. Well, by that criteria, 9/11 didn't kill enough Americans to bring down the government, even though KSM tried to decapitate us. But that's not what the government's for. The government isn't there so that Americans can be stacked up like cordwood in front of the White House to protect the people who think they are our betters. The government exists to protect Americans. And so one of the things that I think it's important for people who listen to your podcast to know is that KSM and those folks are not targeting our government, and they're not targeting our military, because they can't beat our military. They believe that democracy and Sharia law or Islamic law can't exist. They cannot coexist, because in democracy, you get a say in the laws. You get to vote on who leads you. You get to vote on what kind of laws are enforced. And in Sharia law, you simply have to adhere to what's in the Quran, what's in the Hadiths, what's in the perfect words and deeds of the Prophet Muhammad and various scholars who have interpreted what he does. You don't get a say in it. You got to live like they lived 1,400 years ago. The other thing that he made clear to me, KSM made clear to me, was the real battle takes place in the minds and the hearts of and the souls of Americans. He said, you're strong in the military. We can't defeat you on the battlefield, but you are weak in moral resolve, and you don't have the stomach to do what you will need to do to defeat us. He said, he said, we will ultimately defeat you, because even if we can't defeat you on the battlefield, we will immigrate to your country. We will wrap ourselves in your civil liberties for protection. We will feed ourselves off of your welfare while we spread our jihadi message. And then when we're strong enough, we will rise up and impose Sharia law from within, because we're targeting the minds of the American people.
And I'm glad you segued into that, Jim, because I was wanting to bring that up. That's the crux of it. And in some regards, they're winning that battle.
Well, they are, if you look at what's going on right now. You know, KSM would say that this sort of political correctness that we have going on in our country is like a cloaking device so that they can operate in our midst without being challenged. You know, there are apologists both within the media and within Muslim organizations in the United States who are doing kind of that stealth jihad where they slowly mm-hmm. ratchet up the acceptance of Sharia, where every time somebody realistically draws attention to the danger of this kind of creeping Islamism claim, you know, that that's a lot Islamophobia or it's not an American value. There's nothing in our Constitution that says we have to commit cultural suicide by allowing people whose very goals in life is to destroy our way of life to immigrate to our country.
And it's insidious the way they're going about it. And frankly, the Obama administration facilitated this. The mainstream media facilitates this. The whole PC culture. And let's be clear. There's a difference between Islam and radical Islamicists.
Well, there is a difference. What KSM would say about what you had just said is that this, you know, that the fact that we have these civil liberties and the fact that we are willing to give people, other cultures, the benefit of the doubt, and that we are somewhat accepting of multiculturalism, and that we have the Bill of Rights, and that we want the rest of the world to like us, those are all gifts from Allah. Those are all flaws that He's put in our character so that He can, so that guys like KSM can use them
and exploit them, sure.
Sure, and that's the way he thinks about, well, let me tell you how I know the guy because I spent years with him. Let me tell you what he thought about President Obama setting aside his confession. You know, somebody asked me the other day, well, why hasn't anybody been convicted? Why hasn't KSM been convicted? Well, he pled guilty, but President Obama wanted to take a victory lap. So he set aside the confessions, his confessions and the confessions of his co-conspirators, so he could try him again in New York. And what I'm sure what that little homunculus thought once that happened was that this was a gift from his God. This was a sign from his God that he was to continue the jihad inside of the court system. And so now when he goes back to the military commission, guess what? They plead not guilty. And now they're dragging it out because he thinks that what will happen is that his experience in the court system will draw attention to the United States and to the war against, he would say, the war against Islam, and draw like-minded brothers into the fight. Whereas before, he was willing to just plead guilty and martyr himself.
I lived with a bunch of Muslims. I slept with both eyes closed at night. I didn't worry about having my throat cut. And not all of them were Americans. Yet at the same time, our job was to go out and kill the enemy, and I was fine with that. I could separate those things in my mind. I don't hate all Muslims, but the fact of,
well, we couldn't fight the battle against Islamists without the Muslims,
right?
You know, not all Muslim people are Islamists, and this is what I say when people say, "Well, aren't you concerned about, you know, what the so-called moderate Muslim is going to think?" And my answer is no. You know, I'm a white guy from the South. I do not get offended when people talk about the Ku Klux Klan because I'm not a member of the Ku Klux Klan.
Exactly.
So if you're a Muslim and you're not an Islamist, I'm not talking about you. You know, if you don't think that the entire world needs to be under Sharia law and that everybody needs to be converted, slaughtered, or enslaved, I'm not talking about you, so please don't be offended.
And the media and the progressive left use the R word, you know, as a weapon, you know.
Well, they've done the same thing to racism.
Sure.
Yeah, they've done the same thing to racism that they have to torture. That is, they refer to everything as racism and everything is torture. The other day I was talking to somebody and I told them that if you're the kind of person who thinks that macaroni and cheese is racist, you know, or that you have to scramble for a safe space because your history teacher wants to use a quote from Thomas Jefferson, then you really don't get to sit at the big table with the grown-ups while they try to decide what to do about these people who are crucifying children. You just don't have anything to add. You know, there's no way that you can participate in that conversation. You should just stay home and let the people who are experts and committed to protecting you protect you. You know, there are really three takeaways from my book. One of them is the danger of political correctness, which is what we've talked about right now. A second one is the danger of having open borders and inadequate screening of immigrants. You know, remember I told you KSM said like-minded brothers are going to immigrate to the United States. Look at under President Obama, the number of Syrian Muslims, and Syrians, you know, that's just a hotbed for terrorism that sure. they're bringing in versus Christians. Very few Christians, a whole lot of Syrian Muslims, some of whom are claiming to be children, but they're actually fighting-age young men. And then, so there needs to be, we need to close our borders and do a better job of vetting people who want to be immigrants from countries that export terrorists or have terror training camps that are operating in the open. And then the last thing we need to do is we need to have an intelligence-focused detention and interrogation program. You know, we need to get back to capturing and questioning people instead of killing them. You know, Bin Laden's son has recently showed up in propaganda videos calling for death to Americans and calling for lone wolf attacks and calling for attacks inside the United States and attacks in Washington, D.C. and France and Israel. He's exactly the kind of person that we should be capturing and questioning. You know, I know that our current approach to these things is to just drop a hellfire missile on them and kill them and their family and anybody else that happens to be in the house. And I'm not against dropping hellfire missiles on terrorists, but I think you can't find out the long-range intentions by killing off everyone who could provide you with actionable intelligence.
No, it's the easy, low-risk course of action. God forbid should we put boots on the ground. God forbid should we sustain American casualties. So that's been the easy way out is just to hellfire them.
Yes, and the problem, one problem with that is you cannot determine the intentions of your enemy from space. You really do have to talk to somebody. And what we act like, and I'm sure there are people in the intelligence community who don't think this way, but what we act like, especially in the media, is like we take the short-term view, you know. But in fact, they take the long-term view. They have like a 100-year view or a 200-year view. So in the minds of guys like KSM, he's thinking four, five, six moves ahead of the media people who and the political apologists for radical Islam, so that he realizes that we're most vulnerable, not right now, but we're vulnerable two or three generations from now. He told me that he believes that if they attack the minds of the American people long enough, that eventually we're going to, that he said eventually America will expose her neck for us to slaughter. Because he just believes that our offspring are going to be weaker in moral resolve than we are because of the way that some of the liberals and progressives are rewriting history to make us the villains.
I grew up in the 60s, you know, playing Army. I had a Johnny Eagle Thompson machine gun. I had G.I. Joes. When I was a lieutenant in Germany, in Stars and Stripes, some woman complained that they shouldn't be selling war toys to, you know, I guess radicalized children or make them aggressive and warlike. And somebody wrote back saying, you know, you need this in America's youth to protect the freedoms that you have, because at some point, somebody's going to be called upon to do something very unpleasant, like putting cold steel into another human body, and you need this. And I think what I've seen over subsequent generations is, you know, I'm not trying to glorify war, but it's a necessary evil. We have to have a strong military. It's like an insurance policy. And the United States plays this game, you know, after World War I, we demilitarize and we get our ass kicked at Pearl Harbor. And we suffer all these horrible casualties in North Africa because of our weakness. And we have to build back up again. And then we let our guard slip again. It's a cyclic thing. And I hope we change it. You know, it's,
well, I think the problem that we have is that they're trying to feminize men. You know, one of the side effects of this sort of relentless effort to be politically correct is that people are the younger people are losing their hardiness. They're losing their resilience. They're losing their sense of independence and their ability to roll with the kind of changes and stressors that occur. If you think, you know, if you think not getting your tater tots when you drive through McDonald's is a crisis, then you're going to have a lot of trouble when some guy shoots up the airport.
You got to go to your safe space.
Yeah, exactly. You need to go to your safe space. But you do, you know, the way that I've heard it explained to me, a metaphor that I've heard is that men and women in the military are like a great big dog, like a Rottweiler or a Mastiff. It breaks a lot of stuff. It makes a lot of noise. It farts when you have guests over to the house. But when somebody's breaking into the back door, you're damn glad you got it. And that's the problem, I think, is that people forget their right to criticize those people who are keeping them safe is based on the blood and sacrifice of the people before them who died to protect that right. Because you don't get it some other place.
And those people should be thankful every day for the men and women that are out there unseen, that are risking
absolutely
every day to protect those rights for things that they personally probably disagree with.
Yeah. Here's an example. We believe in religious tolerance. So if a radical Islamist wanted to go into most churches, for example, they're free to do it. Let an American who's not a Muslim try to get into Mecca and see what happens. In Saudi Arabia, it's against the law to own a Bible. In Saudi Arabia, it's against the law for two Christians to get together and do Bible study. So those very people who criticize us for not being more inclusive do not give us credit for the level of inclusiveness that we actually have.
I kind of smile to myself when I see these bumper stickers that say coexist. All touchy-feely and nice, but they don't get it that in radical Islam, there is no coexistence.
There isn't.
They have been deaf.
Right. They have been given a holy mandate by their God to either enslave, convert to their version of Islam, because believe me, the people who are most often killed by ISIS and Al-Qaeda are Muslims, not Christians,
mm-hmm.
right? They do kill their fair share of Christians, but ISIS is killing a lot of Muslims because they don't worship Allah the way that they worship Allah. So, you know, it's either convert, enslave, or live in subjugation. Those are the three options that they give you, and they believe that their God has given them the holy mandate to purify the planet, and the only way they can do that is by doing what I just said.
Well,
one of the things that's interesting that I've run into lately is people have asked me about what General Mattis said. You know, when Trump had asked him about, I think he asked him about waterboarding. And of course, it gets taken out of context, and it's been retold so many times that maybe I've gotten pieces of it wrong. The nuance is gone. But in essence, he said, I never really found it very useful. Give me a six-pack of beer and a pack of cigarettes, and I can get more. Well, I think actually the question that General Mattis should ask himself and the question that we should ask ourselves is, what would General Mattis do? Would he be willing to give up information that would get Americans killed for, you know, a Miller and a pack of Winstons? No, he wouldn't.
Of course
not. And KSM didn't either.
And that's what I said. You got to respect these guys because from a warrior standpoint, they're acting much as you or I would under similar circumstances. Different methodology and mentality behind it, but they're fighting for what they believe in.
They are. In fact, I found that the most straightforward interrogation approach for dealing with those guys in terms of how you react to them is what Bruce and I, Dr. Justin and I, call the weary warrior approach. You know, we don't try to pretend anything other than someone who respects what they're trying to do, right? But like them, at this particular point, we grow weary of the fight, you know, and we expect them to resist, and they expect us, since we treat them with respect, to do our jobs as well.
And within their scope of the caliphate and world dominance, Dar al-Harb, or the House of War, is the pathway to Dar al-Islam, the House of Peace, when Islam rules the world.
Right. Like I point out in my book, I had asked him one time, how come you guys call it the religion of peace when all I ever see you do is kill people and blow stuff up? And he said, well, it is the religion of peace because the world will be at peace when the entire world is under Sharia law. And since we are attempting to put the entire world under Sharia law, we are the religion of peace, whereas you are willing to let lots of places, lots of different religions coexist. There will be no peace on this planet until there's one dominant religion, and it's going to be ours.
I think it's important that people understand that mentality and that outlook. Things make
especially when you see spokesmen for this sort of ratcheting up of Sharia on TV saying, well, Islam is the religion of peace. They can say that with a straight face because they use the word peace differently than we do. And the same thing is true for innocence. You know, you can have some of these apologists for the terrorists saying, well, no innocent child should die. But you got to figure out, what do they mean by the word innocent? Well, to be innocent to some of these Islamists, the child first has to be Muslim, and secondly, has to die before they're old enough to make a conscious choice about whether to follow the true path of Islam, right? So that almost automatically excludes all American children.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, what KSM had told me before was that Americans' children are legitimate targets. And they're legitimate targets because your child is one of the reasons that you're fighting for that child's future. You're fighting to resist the imposition of Sharia law because you want to make a better world for your child. If you didn't have a child, it might depress you enough that you would allow this to occur. And so that makes your child a legitimate target.
I think this current administration, in its naivety, or worse perhaps, had, in its effort to understand their enemy, they essentially outsourced their consultation to the enemy because, in my view, CARE and the Muslim Brotherhood are pretty much synonymous as far as the ties. They may speak with an American accent, and they may dress in Western clothes, but their view isn't radically different from that of the Muslim Brotherhood.
I think what you end up with is you end up with people who believe that Sharia law should be imposed by violence, and that there are people who believe that Sharia law should be imposed on the voting booth and through the reshaping of our civil liberties to protect and ratchet up the availability of Sharia. Take a look at what's going on in Europe now. There are some places in Europe where Sharia courts are taking care of civil matters instead of the law of the land. You know, there are places in Sweden and places in other parts of Europe and France that are essentially no-go zones where you have these radicalized Islamist enclaves where if a first responder goes in, they have to have a police escort to get out, you know, because they get attacked by these roving gangs who are trying to maintain Sharia within that particular enclave that they're in.
And there
it's
is
a problem.
No way that should be tolerated in Detroit or anywhere here in the United States. It's an incompatible system with American law, beliefs, and values.
It's cultural suicide. You know, anybody who, here's, you know, I'm an old guy. I'm 65 years old. I spent a lot of time in the military. 30 years total, you know, eight or so working for the CIA and 22 in the military. And anybody who wants to immigrate to the United States and be an American and adopt American values, I say welcome, right? But if you want to come to the United States and you want to bring whatever crappy beliefs created the hellhole you're trying to leave and impose them over here, I would just as soon you stay home.
Yeah. This must have been vindicating writing this book for you, because after being scapegoated and being treated so terribly by, frankly, by the CIA itself and other aspects or parts of the government and the press.
Well, we're still pretty much thrown under the bus by the government. You know, I'm being sued by the ACLU. I'm actually being sued by three enemy combatants. One, I can't talk about the case very much, but I can tell you who they are, right? One of them is a member of Al-Qaeda in East Africa who participated in the bombing of two U.S. embassies, the one in Nairobi, Kenya, and Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. He was a courier for them, a facilitator for them during those bombings. He is suing me. Now, I had never heard of him until his lawsuit showed up on my door. Had nothing to do with his interrogation, nothing to do with his capture, nothing to do with him at all. The second guy who's suing me is a guy by the name of Ben Saud. That wasn't his name when he was fighting us. His name then was Al-Karim. He ran a Libyan terrorist training camp in Afghanistan, training fighters to fight the U.S. forces over there. Another person I never heard of until his lawsuit showed up on my door and didn't have anything to do with his capture, rendition, interrogation, or conditions of detention. Nothing to do with him at all. The third guy is Gul Rockman, who I describe in my book. And the irony of that whole thing is they're suing the only two guys who tried to get him medical care. And the chain of events that led to his death took place 6 days after we left, when the CIA officer who was in charge of that facility chained him so that took his pants and then chained him so that he couldn't get up off the cold concrete floor, and he froze to death while people were supposed to be checking on him hourly. So those three people are suing us. The ones who are the enemy combatants, they can't even get into the United States. They can't even get into, because they're on a watch list. They can't even get into some of the countries that aren't dangerous for my lawyers to go to depose them. They're trying to argue that because they Homeland Security won't let them in our country, that they should be able to testify against me on videotape.
I hope Langley's paying your legal bills.
Well, they are right. They are right now. Yeah, they are paying my legal bills. But they're slow rolling. They're slow rolling the release of documents, and we'll see how that turns out. I'm confident we're going to win, because I can't imagine that three terrorists can sue us. I mean, especially since we had nothing to do with their detention or interrogation. You know,
so pure we'll insanity. See. I would hope that a judge in his right mind would just throw it out of court, but
hasn't happened yet.
No. Jim, we're coming up on our hour, but you are a great American. I thank you again so much for what you've done. And listeners, please go out and buy Enhanced Interrogation, Dr. James Mitchell. I think you'll find it a fascinating read and fascinating insight into the enemy we're facing.